Well, good morning, everyone. Greetings in Jesus' name. It's a blessing to be here. I bring you greetings from Jesus, but also I bring you greetings from the Oasis congregation. And there was one or two, especially Richard, asked that I would, Richard blessed me and said he was happy that I could serve this congregation in this way. Well, you know, they say something about never trust a skinny cook. I'm not really much for that saying. I hope it doesn't apply to, you know, never trust the lame preacher. Hopefully that's not accurate either. You know, we sang the last song, Heavenly Sunlight, you know, walking in sunlight, you know, rejoicing, Jesus is nigh. You know, it's great, great song. And we need to sing songs like that. Do you always feel like that? Do you struggle sometimes to believe? Is Jesus always near when you know that you have to forgive? Is Jesus always near and just giving you the strength and the overcoming power when you know you have to serve and you can't really muster the will inside you to keep on serving? You may be a mom, you may be a father, you may be a church leader, you may be just someone that's annoying, just bugging the tar out of you at work for the 100th time. Sometimes we need encouragement, sometimes we need examples, sometimes we need correction. And in the last few weeks, I had the benefit of having lots of warning about this, and so I've been blessed in the last few weeks being able to consider three characters, and this morning I'd like to draw one word out of each character, one verb. So I'd like to consider, I invite you to the book of Esther for the first one. The book of Esther. Esther, sandwiched between the book of Nehemiah and Job. A little bit of background about Esther. This is roughly 500 years before Jesus Christ. Esther is in a foreign land. She was probably born there. She was probably born in the land of Babylon, somewhere. She's in the capital city here in chapter 1. Well, chapter 1 gives the background of the story of King Ahasuerus. If you remember, the Jews are captive here because of their rebellion and their disobedience to God. And so Nebuchadnezzar, you know, was that king roughly, could have been almost 100 years before, that would have conquered the city numerous times and finally just flattened the city and took everyone back. Everyone that he wanted, anyway, everyone that wasn't dead, back to Babylon. And you have the story of Daniel. So probably Daniel has passed on. This is probably, timeline isn't certain, but it could be a few decades, could be 20, 30 years after Daniel had passed on. Maybe only 15 years, we don't know exactly. So Esther chapter 1, we're not going to read the whole story. But Esther chapter 1 details how King Ahasuerus got mad when his wife, the queen, didn't listen to him in kind of his drunken state. And he kicked her out of the position, kicked her out of the palace. And now he's kind of come around and he said, yeah, we should. He's kind of looking for another wife, and we should have a queen. And so chapter 2 starts off about the plan for replacing Queen Vashti. Verse 8 of Esther 2. So it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan the palace, to the custody of Haggai, that Esther was brought also unto the king's house, to the custody of Haggai, keeper of the women. We see the blessing of God on Esther's life. She just somehow hit it off with this the keeper of the women. Verse 9, he shows favor to her. She has 7 maids. Things were really going in her favor. The story continues on. Verse 15. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the son of the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go in unto the king, she required nothing but what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. We're seeing a few little nuggets about Esther's character here. There was one in chapter 15. Verse 17, the king loved Esther. He places the crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Verse 20. Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people. Just an interesting little nugget there, kind of reflects verse 10 as well. The story continues. Chapter 3, Haman comes on the scene. Haman cannot stand Mordecai's guts. Obviously, Mordecai is Esther's stepfather. Very involved in her life, very interested, but obviously now separated because Esther is in the palace and he on the outside. He's a trusted advisor of the king. But one of the things that he does not do is bow down to Haman when Haman is walking in and out of the palace. This bugs Haman. And the rest of Haman's friends kind of egg him on a little bit and is like, hey, you know, check this out. This guy never bows. Did you notice? And Mordecai was open with his fellow counselors because he never bowed. They asked him, well, why don't you bow? You're going to pay for this. He's like, well, he said, I can't. I'm a Jew. I serve the God. I serve the living God. I can't bow. And so Haman notices this, is infuriated by it. He's like, okay, he's a Jew. I'm probably going to have trouble with all the Jews. And so he puts his plan in place. He pays for it. He and the king sign the deal. Chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai perceived all that was done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry. He couldn't go into the king. Verse 3, and in every province, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews, and fasting, and weeping, and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Well understood, because their extermination debt, their extermination date was set. It was a number of months in the future. They had cast lots to figure out when. So it was months in the future. But it was set. They were going to be wiped out as a people. Verse 4. So Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told it to her. Then was the king exceedingly grieved, and she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai and to take away his sackcloth from her. But he Levin is like, no, you can't do that. Everyone knows that if you aren't... And she said, I haven't been called into the king for 30 days. It's not happening. Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place, but thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. Well, that was very true. Mordecai was part of her father's house. Mordecai was the issue. There's no way that Esther would escape being closely connected with Mordecai. The last part of the verse. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed, and who knoweth whether thou art come into the kingdom for such a time as this? Then Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer. Go, gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise, and so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went his way, or something like that. This was a real fast. A black fast, no water, no food, 3 days. And then she was going to do, so put it all on God, and then do what she had to do. If you are a Christian today, why have you come into the kingdom? Have you come into the kingdom to enjoy the blessings of the palace? Have you come into the kingdom? Have I come into the kingdom so I can enjoy the blessing and security and, you know, being in the center of the Father's will and knowing that his love is showered on me? Is that why, the only reason why I am come into the kingdom? Or have you come into the kingdom for such a time as this? Are you called to the kingdom to serve? It's risky serving. It's risky serving. Usually your reputation takes a beating. Usually some people misunderstand your service. Usually there's lots of things that can happen when you serve. But is that why you have come into the kingdom? Is that why God has placed you where you are and called you? How could Esther do it? I'd like to think about that a little bit. And how can we do that? And so this is a big topic, and this is not my... we have two other words and two other people that I'd like to look at. But Esther had come to serve, and she was willing to sacrifice. She said, if I perish, I perish, but I'm willing to go ahead with this plan. And I'd like to consider what a little bit of the foundation that she was standing on. She was probably pretty young. She could have been 16, 17, maybe 18 years old when she was crowned queen. I don't know how much time had passed, but she was still pretty young, is my guess. I have no solid proof of that, other than just understanding and reading through some of the requirements. But going back to, how did she relate to Mordecai? Mordecai was her stepfather. Her father and her mother had died. So she was handed a bit of a tough lot in life, you know, an orphan. But she stood on the foundation that she was given. And I'd like to notice, in backing up in chapter 2, verse 10, she hadn't told anyone that she was a Jew. because Mordecai told her, don't. This was before she was king, after she was anointed or made queen. In verse 20, it says again that she didn't disclose this information about herself because Mordecai had told her. And it says, Esther did the commandment of Mordecai like as when she was brought up with him. She was part of his family. And she just simply obeyed Mordecai. And here is a very basic foundation, a very basic platform that Esther was standing on. She couldn't control what was happening, but she did obey Mordecai. And when it came down, Mordecai said, you got to go into the king. She was like, no. And Mordecai said, yes. And this is why. And she said, okay. If she wouldn't have been obedient to Mordecai when she was 13, do you think she would have been obedient to Mordecai now that she was 19 years old and being told to do something that would potentially cost her head? You see, we build a platform of stability for ourselves when we simply come under God's plan. And it's interesting to note that the commandment, number 5 of the 10 commandments, is honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the earth. The New Testament picks that up in Ephesians 6, honor thy father and thy mother, that it may be well with thee. And so this is a challenge, and I'm not just talking to young people, I'm talking to everyone. As Esther stood on that foundation, and that is a foundation that you cannot manufacture by yourself. You can't go back and, you know, be nice, but evade that commandment and somehow still get that platform of blessing. It doesn't happen. Esther stood on that platform because she had built that for herself. That's one platform that I struggled with. It's one commandment that I really struggled with. And I remember being, this is embarrassing to admit it, but I remember being 18 years old and still not being able, going through a very significant time phase of my life where Dad and I just didn't see eye to eye. And he was a man of few words. And he would make a decision on the farm or otherwise. And I was like, well, that had made absolutely no sense to me. There was 3 other good ways to go, and he picks the dumbest one. And I had to go back to him time after time and say, Dad, I'm sorry for not respecting you. I'm sorry for what I said. And it wasn't until I finally got a hold of that issue in my life that I started to move forward in my Christian life. And it's embarrassing to admit it, but that's the way it was. And I would encourage you, you say, well, and I don't know your parents for the most part. I mean, I know them to see them, but I really don't know them. And so I could say, well, but if I would have parents like, you know, if I'd have parents like Layton, you know, then I would have been able to, right? Or if I would have parents like Jason, like if I would have a dad like Jason, you know, a minister of the gospel, I remember sitting in the church as a boy listening to Jason's dad preach. He was an excellent preacher. And I still remember that. I could say, well, if I would have had, you know, Abner for a dad, you know, it would be totally different. But God didn't give me Abner for a dad. God gave me Morris for a dad. and that I had to learn to obey and honor Morris. That was the issue. And that is the platform that we can then stand on and serve. That's one of the things. You say, well, I can't do that. No way. You don't know my parents. I understand there are times when you have to, after much thought and prayer, you need to follow God. I wholly support that. But just walking away from godly parents' advice is not a thing to be done lightly. Please understand me. You say, why? Can't do it. Can't do it. Well, guess what? Jesus did. And Luke 2 talks about when Jesus, and I invite you to Luke 2. Luke chapter 2, and breaking into the center of the chapter. Well, towards the end. Verse 42. Luke 2, verse 42. And when he, Jesus, was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. And it talks about, it goes on, they return, they're at the feast, they're at Jerusalem at the feast. They head back to Galilee. It's a long trek. Day, they're going to be on the road for days. And the first day, it's like, well, Jesus is somewhere, you know. They kind of spent all day, you know, going from group to group in there. And at the end of the day, he's not around. They turn back to Jerusalem. Verse 46, and it came to pass that after 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions. And all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. And when they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said unto him, Son, why hast thou thus dealt with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee sorrowing. And he said unto them, How is it that ye sought me? Wist ye not that I must be about my father's business? And they understood not the saying which he spake unto them. This was truly a case of parents not understanding the child, if there ever was one. He was doing his father's will. But what does the next verse say? Verse 51, he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject unto them. Is there any connection between verse 51 and verse 52? Jesus increasing in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. Jesus showed us an example. My challenge to you is serve. Stand on the platform that you've been given and serve. Esther, as a very unique type of Jesus Christ, was willing to give her life for her people in service. For even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister. That's Jesus. I'd like to invite you to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37. We don't have a lot of time to read. It's the story of Joseph. Can someone tell me how old is Joseph at the beginning of chapter 37 of Genesis? How old is he? Anyone? 17. Thank you. What is one really good thing that Joseph has going for him? Anyone? Rich family? What else? Exactly. Yeah. He's he knows he's really loved by his family, by his father. Kind of a double-edged sword. How? How was his father's favor and love? Kind of a catch-22, where he benefited from it, but he also didn't. Yeah. His brothers couldn't stand his guts. You see how many times it mentions the word hate in the first few verses? It mentions it in verse 4. He starts telling his dreams, mentions it again in verse 5. Verse 8, it mentions hate again. Another dream. Verse 11, his brothers envied him. He's moving into really dangerous territory. His brothers go off, take all his father's flocks off to the boonies to find grass for him. A few weeks later, Joseph is sent out. His brothers said, "Ah, this is our chance. We're gonna get rid of this dreamer. We're going to see how his big fairy tales actually pan out." And Reuben caught him and said, "No, don't kill him. Don't kill him. Let's just put him in this pit." Because Reuben, being the oldest, knew he was responsible, and he just wanted to save his life. He wanted to get him out of the pit and let him go. And we know the story. Reuben leaves to attend something else. The traders come along, and Judah said, "Let's make some cash." They didn't have much cash in those days. They had a lot of flocks, but probably not a lot of cash. How many pieces of silver is he sold for? 20, one of those two, either 20 or 30, you can verify that. He's taken to Egypt, and I really don't think that Joseph had a smile on his face all the way to Egypt. I'm guessing there were some tears shed, and even hot tears shed on the way to Egypt. But God saw to it that he wasn't sold as a construction slave, because construction slaves didn't really last very long in Egypt. There was no ministry of labor. Well, there's ministry of labor, but not this type of MOL that construction workers think of today. He sold the Potiphar's house, and all of a sudden, something happens in verse 39. Genesis 39, verse 2. "And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand." There's something going on in Joseph's life here. I don't see Joseph as a bitter man, because a bitter man and a prosperous man don't really... That doesn't really mesh. Joseph found grace in his sight, verse 4, and he made him overseer over his house, and all that he had he put into his hand. Verse 5, it talks about the blessing. God just pours out the blessing. You know, if Joseph is in charge of something, God blesses it. And Joseph grows into this over the course of a few years. And he's the man in charge. And then comes the test. Potiphar's wife. And Potiphar's wife was not a man of principle, was not a lady of principle, as was Joseph, a man of principle. But we see Joseph's commitment to a clear conscience. He wasn't going to compromise that. Even though he was never going to see his brothers and father and mother again, wasn't happening. He wasn't going to sacrifice a clear conscience. He gets tossed into jail, probably a number of years between Potiphar's house and jail. he spends 12, there's 12 or 13 years that go by. So let's say he was in Potiphar's house for 5 years. You can do the math and know immediately how many years he was in jail. But in jail, the same thing happens. The jailer puts stuff in, he gives Joseph charge because Joseph just does a super job at taking care of stuff. And Joseph is open to people. He's open to his fellow prisoners. He's not sitting there glumly with his chin in his hands. No, he notices that, well, one day is the baker and the butler. They're having a really bad day. And Joseph is a free man. God is prospering him. He's blessing him. He interprets the dream. He gets forgotten about for another 2 years. Pharaoh has a dream. And the butler says, oh, right. I forgot about someone. Joseph gets hauled out of prison. He interprets Pharaoh's dream, and he's put over Egypt. And there's 7 good years. So this is 20 years now after he left Canaan. Two years into the famine, his brothers show up. He runs him through a series of tests to try to figure out what kind of men are they? How do they view their father? What's their attitude toward their other brother, Benjamin? And when he finds that out, and he discloses his identity to them, he says, I am Joseph. In chapter 45, verse 3, he says, I am Joseph. Doth my father yet live? And his brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. And Joseph said unto his brethren, come near unto me, I pray you. And he starts telling them about the history. Verse 7, he says, God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity. Verse 8, so now it was not you that sent me hither, but God. Verse 9, God hath made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down unto me, and tarry not. And he sent carts and stuff back to move them all down, all the family back down to Egypt. After his dad dies, fast forwarding a number of years, his brothers, not again evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring to pass as it is this day to save much people alive. Therefore fear ye not, I will nourish you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spake kindly unto them. What a shining star of forgiveness. There was no bitterness in Joseph's life. All the way through, you can see in Egypt, there was no bitterness. Did he struggle? I'm sure he did. But he was a free man. And that's when you can let go of bitterness and when you can let go of what those people owe me. When you can let that go and forgive, you're free. You're free. And life takes a lot of forgiveness. Spouses, you need to be good forgivers. Children to parents, you need to forgive. Parents to children, you need to forgive. Brothers to brothers, in the church, in the family, co-workers. Life takes a lot of forgiveness. Roughly 1,700 years after Joseph, another man, the Son of Man, hung on a cross and he said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. He was forgiving proactively. He was forgiving before they even asked for forgiveness. Roughly 1,900 years after Jesus Christ, there was a lady speaking in the church of Munich, the church in Munich, Germany. 2 years after World War II had ended, Germany was in ruins. And the morale of the people were in ruins as well. And she was speaking in the church, and she spoke of she was getting to be well known. And she spoke of God's forgiveness, of the need of the hope that Christians have. And afterwards, she stepped down from the platform, and she was meeting some of the people as she made her way through the crowd. And one older man came up to her and said, I mean, this is all in German, obviously, and said, "Frau, thank you so much for your message. I too have become a Christian, and I am told that God forgives me, but I've done a lot of bad things. And you said you were at Ravensbrück. I served at Ravensbrück as a guard. And can I just hear it from your mouth? Do you think that God would forgive me as well? And would you forgive me?" And just like that, it was like a thunderbolt struck her, and she was frozen. This man had his hand outstretched. He was smiling, and she stood there like a wooden soldier. Because in that instant, she remembered some of the humiliation that this man, this guard, had put them through at the concentration camp. In an instant, she saw her Betsy, her sister, dying. And she saw the carcass of Betsy with, you know, that thin skin just kind of stretched over her bones, dying because of inattention and sickness. And she said, "God, I cannot forgive this man." And time seemed to stand still. And she said, "God, I know I need to." She said, "God, if I somehow force my hand forward, can you do everything else?" And the man said again, "Could you forgive me?" And he was waiting. And she pushed her hand forward, and she said it was almost like an electric current raced down her arm, and she grabbed the man's hand, and she said, "Brother, I forgive you. God bless you." Forgiveness is part of the way. I'd invite you to Daniel, the book of Daniel. Daniel was a young man here. We don't have a lot of, we just want to skip through the first few chapters here of Daniel. He's a young man going by the language that is used to describe Daniel. Again, I would put him quite young. Spanish calls him a muchacho. So that means, like, you know, not, you don't call someone that's 18 a muchacho. You know, it's someone that's like, you know, 14, maybe 15. They just say the children of Israel. Here, some call him youth. I would think somewhere between 14 and 16. He was young, but he was dedicated. He was hauled from, his parents were probably killed because he was part of the royal seed. Usually invading armies didn't take too kindly to the royalty, because they were usually the problem, right? The problem for the rebellion. So Daniel and numerous other Jews get hauled back to Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar's commandment. I don't know what kind of meats. It was probably unclean meats as well. But right from get-go here, Daniel shows his consecration, and he believes that it's worthwhile following God. And consecration, when I think of the word consecrated, the word toothbrush comes to mind. I don't know if you have a family toothbrush or not. We don't at our house. I mean, if it's your toothbrush, it's your toothbrush. And you don't necessarily share it. If someone forgot their toothbrush, kind of tough luck, or, well, where's the nearest store? you know. But that toothbrush is consecrated to you. It's yours. You don't go contaminating the toothbrush and think it's still fine to use. And here we see, I see Daniel as God's toothbrush. He's consecrated. He believes that it's worthwhile to follow God. And he goes way out on a limb and he says, look, just try us for 10 days. It's like, 10 days? A 10-day diet? What's that going to do? But God, Daniel knows that it's up to God, right? And God blesses that. When God sees commitment, then God in turn says, okay, that's good. And God steps forward with his blessing. But he usually waits to see commitment first. We see God blessing Daniel. We see he has a brush with death in chapter 2, and he learns the importance of prayer. They prayed as though their lives depended on it because they did. Verse 3, Daniel's not around. Chapter 3. They face the golden image. Daniel's not around. But his three friends are still standing, even without Daniel. And that's a testimony. When you believe God, and when you believe that God's way is worth it, it has an effect on the people around you. Chapter 4 and chapter 5, we don't have time to get into that, but Daniel again is growing older, and he clearly speaks truth to two separate kings that have the potential to get him killed. There's a changing of the guard, total change of government in chapter 6. The beginning of chapter 6, it's now the Medes and the Persians running the show. Daniel is well into his 70s by now, if not older. And what happens? Here's a bit of a window into a person's life that has been totally committed to God. Someone who has believed that it's worthwhile to follow God all his life. Here you have it. And I don't know if I'm ever going to get there. I don't think I will. But verse 3 of chapter 6, it says, Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him. At chapter 4, he had his share of enemies. They sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could not. Could find none occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. He left just a clear trail. I mean, you ask my coworkers, oh, they could cough up some issues that Ross has, but not with Daniel. And they finally said, you know what? We're not going to make any charge stick on him. We're going to have to do something that we know is going to work. And that's regarding him and his God. They knew. Everyone knew. Everyone knew that Daniel, the king knew. Everyone knew that Daniel was totally committed to God. He believed that it was worthwhile serving God. And he believed so much that he was, didn't matter whether he was on a business trip, didn't matter whether he was at home. Didn't matter whether his colleagues wanted to go out for lunch. I mean, it was like, oh, no, oh, right, yeah, Daniel can't go to lunch, right? He's got to go and pray, you know, sure. It was clockwork, morning, noon, and night. Daniel was in his house praying, and they knew it, and they designed a law to catch him. They assembled, they found him praying just as he had all this time, it says, in chapter 10, as he did aforetime. This was his habit. This was his routine. And they said, we got him. Just before they drop him, the king is really, really displeased with himself. The king can't believe that he messed up like this. He should have known that this was going to catch Daniel, but he forgot. And before they dropped him into the den of lions, the king says, thy God, whom thou servest continually, he will deliver you. They drop him in, they seal it. The king had a sleepless night. And early in the morning, king ran to the tomb, he got the stone lifted off. And it's the first thing he said, he asked, Daniel, is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee? Daniel believed. In verse 23, then was the king exceedingly glad for him, and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him, because he believed in his God. Is it worthwhile? Is a life of believing God worth it? Is it really worth it? I would encourage you to serve, forgive, and believe. Someday we will see that it was worth every sacrifice, everything. God bless you as you serve the people around you, as you serve your family, as you serve your church. God bless you as you walk forward and forgive, lean on Jesus for strength, and as well, believe, never stop believing, that faith pleases God. God bless you. Let's stand for prayer. Let's pray. Our Father in heaven, we come to you. We ask for grace and strength and understanding to serve and forgive and believe. May your hand be upon each one here. May you bless each one. May you strengthen each one. May you strengthen the faith that is here. And I pray that you would raise up examples, men and women here that are dedicated to you, that are consecrated, men and women that believe that the sacrifice here will be worth so much more in eternity. Guide and direct our steps for your glory in Jesus' name. Amen. You may be seated.